welcome to a new year at last. this schedule of doing one thing before Rosh Hashanah and then starting the new year after Sukkot is very strange to me still. It's hard to get used to. Nonetheless, welcome to the first in a year-long series, God willing, on King Solomon's Ark. Ark, A-R-C, not Ark like A-R-K, this week's Torah portion, in which we're going to look at least, I hope, the first 11 chapters of the book of Malachim, the book of Kings. Those are the ones that focus on the life and career of Shlomo HaMelech, of King Solomon. If we get through those, then we can move on to talk about what happens after him. But let's not be too ambitious at the outset. Let's, you know, keep it to the first 11 chapters and be happy, if that works out. I am grateful to Rebecca Nadler for making this possible, via Mikorot. If any of you have not yet, taken care of your registration, please do speak to Rebecca. I'm gonna put the link in the chat. With the email address. Nope, that didn't work. Why not? There it goes. Okay. Mikorot18@gmail.com. So you could always be in touch with Rebecca that way. I'm grateful to Shari Shanayim for being willing to host this at some point in the future. When that will be, we'll see. But for now, we're on Zoom. Even when we do, God willing, switch to Shari Shanayim, we're going to continue to offer a Zoom option. Rebecca just put the link in the chat, the direct link for the registration form. That's great. General information to be aware of. I plan to continue to record and upload audio to YU Torah. And when I send out the email each week with the source sheet, it will also include a link to past recordings, so people who miss a session or just want to review greatest hits will be able to do that. The space that I'm in is a new one for me, because my Beit Midrash is now back at Or Chaim full-time, thank God. I needed to find a room that would be available for all the different classes at all the different times. And the one room that fit that is sort of a closet off the hallway, off of the main hallway, which means I hear a weird echo. I don't know how it is for you. I hope that the sound is okay. It also means, though, that in between classes, there are going to be a lot of people passing right outside this room. I think it's 217 to 220 or something like that. So we may have a few minutes in which, you know, we're dealing with some noise. I have an option of trying to get fancy headphones and a microphone. We'll see. But just be aware that may be an issue. Okay. So this session is actually also dedicated by Evie Taven in memory of Yechezkel Yehuda Ben Chaim Tuvia, Howard, Denmark. Evie actually will be joining a little bit later. Okay. Let's launch in. The first thing I want to say about King Solomon's Ark is not about the Ark, but rather about the name. I am likely to go back and forth this year between King Solomon, Shlomo, Shlomo HaMelech, Melech Shlomo. If it's ever confusing, you know, let me know, please. It's just natural. My natural tendency is to think of him as Shlomo HaMelech. Right? The Hebrew term. But recognizing that may pose a challenge at times, so I'm gonna throw in King Solomon's as well. I'm trying to use King Solomon in my translations on the source sheets. But yeah, let me know if at some point you're finding that, challenging. I begin by noting that Shlomo is a fascinating figure. He has made it into popular culture. He's really an icon when you think about it. People talk about the wisdom of Solomon. There's a plant called Solomon's seal, although I can't find a good explanation for why the plant is actually called Solomon's seal. I've seen some very odd explanations online, The best one so far that I have found is simply because, as we'll see later this year, King Solomon is known as a botanist. He's a plant expert. And why that plant should be associated with him is not clear. Maybe it has medical capacity in some sense, and it's I don't know. They talk about King Solomon's mines, right? There's literature and I think a movie related to that. For the comic book fans, the superhero Shazam, the first letter S is supposed to stand for Solomon. Christianity loves King Solomon, and not only that, but Islam loves King Solomon. There's material in the Quran about Shlomo, material that does not appear in the Tanakh. They have a story about him walking with King David in a field, and then someone comes to there, walking with King David, and somebody comes to them to a dispute about a field. He's all over Shlomo HaMelech. And my question that I would put to you to start us off is, would you view Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, as a biblical hero? As a role model. What would you say? Yes, Ruth.
I think he's a person in conflict with himself in time. He's one person at one time, and then you can see him changing. And at the end, I don't think he's sure what he was supposed to be. So you read his Megillot and his books, and it shows many, many signs, and some of them are not heroic.
So that's a fascinating thing. When we think of Shlomo HaMelech, when we think of King Solomon, we can't only think in terms of the 11 chapters that we're going to focus on this year. We have to look at Divrei Hayamim, the Book of Chronicles, Aleph and Bet, because those are going to give us additional insight that you don't see in the Book of Malachim, the Book of Kings. We have three books in Tanakh that are credited to him. Some of them, the books say it explicitly that it's him. Some of them a little less explicitly. But Mishle, the Book of Proverbs, Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, and Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. And if you ever want a confusing book, Ecclesiastes is your book. I've actually been toying with the idea that after we finish this, maybe we should just go on to Ecclesiastes and tackle that one. But when you put all of that literature together, you get definitely, it looks like there's more than one Solomon. It really does. Ruchama.
There is also something extremely unique to Shlomo HaMelech, that when God asked him, Bahalom, what should I give you? And he didn't ask for money, he didn't ask for but he asked that God will give him more sechel lishpot. So this is an amazing thing. Who would ask for such a thing? This is typical to Shlomo.
Right. So that's a beautiful point also. The fact that Shlomo HaMelech, that King Solomon, his request, which we'll get to, God willing, when God offers him everything, his request is, make me a good leader. That's what he asks for. It's a beautiful thing. Rebecca, you were going to say?
It is a beautiful thing, but remember that he has so much money and so much power because his father's left him in such a good position. And at the same time, the stories, and we have the stories we were told as children about his wisdom, etc. But look what happens to the kingdom during his reign and where it ends up.
And after his
reign. This is not something that most of us would like to be remembered for.
Yeah. No, this is really hard. It's very interesting when you read the stories about him. It reminds me of something that I'm going to speak about not tomorrow morning, but in my next Wednesday series, which starts a week from Wednesday. I'm going to be talking about Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, the Rashba. And he engaged in polemics and response to Islamic polemics against Judaism. And one of the points that he responds to is, it's fascinating, there's a fellow by the name of Ibn Khazm. Those who were in a series I taught last year may remember him. He lived in the 11th century. He was Muslim. And he wrote against Judaism. And Ibn Khazm said, the Torah that we have is a forgery. it's not the legitimate original Torah. And one of his proofs is that the great figures in Judaism are portrayed as being so flawed. The fact that it lists Yaakov did this and Reuven did that, and the Rashba looks at him and says, no, that's proof that this is legitimate. We would never have written such a thing about it, about our leaders ourselves. And you look at Solomon, you look at Shlomo, and no one would want to write such a thing about their leaders. Yes, Solomon married all of these women and these concubines, and they led him astray into idolatry. The end. It doesn't fit. Ricky.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
In spite of everything he inherited, and in spite of his qualities, and in spite of everything he did, it's still David Melech Israel. He is not considered the Melech Israel. It's still David.
Right. So one of the major things we have to get to is his legacy. How do we view him? That takes me back to my original question. Thank you for the segue. Of how do we view him? No one sings, you know, during Hakafos on Simchas Torah, no one sings Shlomo, Melech Yisrael. Like, that's, you know, that's just not the way we look at him. So I'm going to move forward just because there's a lot to talk about to introduce this. Even though I know there are more things that we could say. On the sheet, I referred you to four different biblical passages that really highlight the problem. And I see that in the chat, Morty put in a little bit of information about Solomon's seal. Yeah, that's one of those. The resemblance of the scars to triangles that were his symbol. Okay, that's another one. I've found a few explanations. I don't know, but the first passage that I gave you, and I did ask in the email that I sent out for people to have a Tanakh with them. But I'm going to share with you the first passage that I put on the sheet, and then we'll move into the passages that are from Malachim. But this is from Shmuel Bet, and specifically the birth of a son to Bathsheba, after that whole incident of David, Uriah, Bathsheba, which is not going to be a major topic this year, but it is going to affect some of the things that happen that we'll learn about, so we're going to come back to it. But in this passage, we are told, it's sentences 24 and 25, Vayenachem David et Bathsheba ishto. David comforted Bathsheba, who was by this time his wife. Vayavo elah vayishkab imah, he was with her. Vateled bein, she gave birth to a son. Vatikra es shemo Shlomo, and she names him Shlomo. Vahashem ahivo, and God loved him. And then the next line, Vayishlach b'yad Nasan Hanavi, God sent via the prophet Natan, Vayikra Shemo Yedidya, gave him another name, Yedidya. Yedid is a friend or a beloved. Yedidya, beloved of God. Ba'avur Hashem, for God. He was God's beloved. That's a name that Shlomo carries with him. He is chosen from the get-go. And then, now you can open up your book of Malachim. Chapter 9, sentences 6 to 14. I'm going to come back to the whole Malachim 1, Malachim 2 thing shortly. I'll discuss that a little bit. But right now, I'm just calling it Malachim. So chapter 9, sentences 6 to 14. And what you find there is the following promise that God gives to him. And I'm going to just translate it on the fly. I'm not going to read out the Hebrew. If you and your children will retreat from following God, if you're not going to follow God, and you won't guard the mitzvot, and you won't guard the laws that I've given you, and you go to serve the gods of others, and you bow to them, then I'm going to cut everybody off from the land. This isn't actually the passage that I wanted. I don't know why I did 9. I think what I wanted was 3. I apologize. Either that or I wanted 10. But it's not the passage that I wanted. That passage is important, but it's not where I was going. Hang in there. No. Sorry. Not the passage that I wanted. Anybody know which passage I wanted? I'm going to do this an easier way. Bear with me for a moment. Okay. The passage that I meant to give you is chapter 3, sentences 6 to 14. I don't know why I put 9 in my notes. But what you find there is that Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, is given wisdom by God. And that's what I wanted to highlight. If you take a look.
Yes.
Sorry?
No, that's what I mentioned before.
Yeah, correct.
That's what you may think.
Okay. Correct. So God says to him, I am going to make you so wise. If you jump to sentence 12 or 3, sentence 12, God says, I have done as you requested. I have given you a heart that is wise and understanding. No one like you lived before, and no one like you will arise after you. You are the wisest of the wise. And then we're going to see in chapter 5, sentences 18 and 19, and there it is correct, that Shlomo says, God has now gotten rid of all of my enemies. Nobody is obstructing me. No one is going to be able to harm me. I would like to do what my father David was not able to do. I would like to build a Beit HaMikdash. I would like to build a temple for God. He is righteous. But then you go to chapter 11, the beginning of chapter 11. And I realize this isn't the reason why chapter 11 is the bankruptcy legislation. Nonetheless, look at the beginning of chapter 11, and you find King Solomon loves many foreign women and the daughter of the Pharaoh who he married earlier. He loves women of Moab, he loves women of Ammon, he loves all of them. And from all the nations of whom God said, I don't want you marrying among them, they're going to sway your heart, Shlomo loves them. How many are we talking about? Sentence 3 tells us 700 wives and 300 concubines. What that's about, we're going to come back to, obviously, when we get to that chapter. But that's a lot. And you find, unsurprisingly, that as we continue, his heart is swayed by them to follow the cultures and religions they came from. And the text actually accuses Shlomo in sentence 7 of building an altar to Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Molech, the god of Ammon, and the wives are bringing offerings to their gods. Like, you read this, and how in the world is all of this going to fit into a single personality? And then, take a look on the sheet, please, at source number 5. A Gemara in Sanhedrin. This Gemara is fascinating for so many reasons. We're not going to see it in all its glory. But this is, in context, part of a discussion of what it takes to be excluded from Olam Haba, to be excluded from the next world. Whatever the next world means is not even our topic of conversation right now. But this chapter begins by saying, all of us have a share in the next world. Kol Yisrael Yesham Chalek L'Olam Haba. Everyone gets in. The following people don't get in. Here's who's not on the guest list. And this source here, this passage from the Talmud in source number 5, says, you know, there was actually somebody else they meant to include on the list of those who don't get in. But I'm just going to mute because I hear random noise. There was somebody else who was supposed to be on the list of those who don't get in and then wasn't included. And look at this story here in source number 5. Bikshu od limnos echad. They wanted to list another one. But, and it doesn't say who it is, but I put in the brackets in my translation, it's King Solomon. but they don't actually tell you it's King Solomon. The way the commentators know it's King Solomon is if you take a look at source number 6, there's a version of the story that appears in the Jerusalem Talmud, and there they tell you explicitly who it is. That Bikshu Letzayefet Shlomo Imahen, they wanted to include Solomon on the list of those who don't make it into the next world. So going back to source number 5. But the Mustiyukno Shel Aviv V'nishtatcha Lifneihem, the image of his father, of King David, came and bowed before them. Please don't put my son on your list. V'lo ishgichu ala, they didn't pay any attention. Ba'esh min ha-shamayim, fire comes out of the heavens. V'lichacha es basaf saleihem, and it licks at their benches they're sitting on. V'lo ishgichu ala, they didn't pay any attention. Yatza baskol, a voice comes out of the heavens. The Amralem says to them, it quotes a verse from Mishle, from Proverbs, which of course is Solomon's own book. The line from Mishle, Chazisa ish mahir b'malachto, lifnei melachim yisyatzav, bal yisyatzav lifnei chashukim. Have you seen a man who is quick in his work? He will stand before kings, he will not stand before those who are darkened. And says the text here, that refers to the work he did in building the Beis HaMikdash, building the first temple. Misha Hikdim Beisila Beiso. He built my house, God says, before he built his own. Veloot Elisha Beisi Bana Besheva Shanim Ubeiso Bana Beshloshes Reishana. With mine, he built it in 7 years. His, he took 13. Not because he needed 13, but because he didn't rush the contractor. I've had conversations with people here about contractors. He did not rush the contractor for his own, but for mine, 7 years. Such a person will stand before kings, not before darkened ones, meaning he should be admitted into Olam Haba. He should be admitted into the next world. And the sages were not impressed. They paid no attention. Now, if you're reading this story for the first time, you may be wondering, what's the big deal about this list? So a group of human beings, rabbis, sages, got together and made a list of who doesn't make it into the next world. At the end of the day, God is the one who decides. So that's how the passage concludes. Yatza Baskol Va'amra, a voice comes out and says, quoting from the book of Iyo, from the book of Job, Hame'imcha Yishalamena. Are you in charge of the tashlumin? Are you in charge of the payment, such that you say he doesn't get in? Ki atah tivchar v'lo ani. You get to choose, not me. Talk about what you know. Don't talk about what you don't know. So enough of trying to decide who gets into the next world. But my point in bringing this is not so much the discussion about sages in the Talmud deciding who gets into the next world, as the very fact that we're having this conversation. The whole idea that we're having this conversation about excluding him from Olam Haba is just shocking. And so what I want to do is talk about how this happened. Who is this man? And what does it mean for us? It's a much bigger story than just his. It's also a story of a nation. It's a story of a king. It's a story of a father and son relationship. There's so much that's going on here. It's a story of an awful lot of marriages. But we need to figure out something here over the course of this year. And the method I want to use is like what we did with Esther and Ruth when we learned them on Tuesdays last year, which means that we're going to be very text-based, but I'm going to do it by highlighting topics within each chapter and discussing them, as opposed to doing an intense line-by-line read. Because if we do a line-by-line read, this will take us 3 years, not one. So I'm planning on doing it by topics, and you'll see the topics in a moment. Are we clear on where we are? Good? Everyone's being very quiet. I knew the opening session was going to be more me talking than everybody else, but that doesn't last. Any questions before we go further? Okay. So I gave you on the sheet source number 7. This comes from the introduction to Malachim, to the book of Kings. I'm going to go back and forth between Malachim and Kings, just like between Shlomo and Solomon. Professor Yehuda Kiel is the editor of the Dat Mikra edition of Malachim. I have one here, and for anyone who has the Hebrew, I definitely recommend it. And in his introduction, he gives you a breakdown of what he considers the first section of the book of Malachim, the life of Shlomo, the life of Solomon. So he gives you the verse breakdown. I added some explanation for each part. It starts with how he became king in the first place. Then it continues as he establishes his monarchy. And that includes an awful lot. That includes conversations with God. It includes an attempted revolt by one of his brothers. Then the grandeur of the new empire. We move into the building of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, and Solomon's palace, dedication of the Beit HaMikdash. Then his second vision with God. It's actually his third, but Kiel calls it his second. In which God promises that he will continue and protect the line of David and Solomon, and that God will be in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. Then you find out things that Shlomo did for the security, as I wrote there, and the economy, and how nations seek him out for his advice. Chapter 10 is utopia. Everything that God has promised is going to come true. And then in chapter 11, everything goes downhill. Everything is just demolished. So if you look at source number 8, you'll see I gave you a list of topics that I'm currently considering discussing in each chapter. I'm not going to read out the whole list. I just wanted you to have a sense of sort of where we're going and what we're going to discuss. And also, if you see something as you're looking at Malachim that's not on here, and you think, you know, we should really discuss that, let me know. We may add it. But these are the main things that I'm looking to understand. They're not all Solomon based. Meaning if you look at chapter 1, the story of King David's illness right at the beginning of the book, we have to talk about that. You can't not talk about David's illness. By the way, it will be also a Haftorah coming up pretty soon, so it'll be relevant for that. Natan the prophet, who was the one who named Shlomo, as we read before, he's also the one who is going to tell David that his son is rebelling against him via Bathsheba. So we're going to talk about Natan. We're going to have to talk about Bathsheba. We're going to go through the jobs that King David leaves for King Solomon to take care of. We will have to see the wisdom of Solomon and what all of that is about. We get a lot of detail in chapter 4 about his government. We need to understand why that's there. And then after that, it becomes very Solomon-focused until you get to the end and the schism that arises in the kingdom. But this is a little bit of a roadmap of where we're going. Okay? Still good? Okay. So here's what we need to know in order to get into this. First of all... Yeah, Ricky.
Sorry, when you say chapter, does it mean shiur?
No, by no means. Chapter means perek. There will be some of these chapters that I could see being 3 weeks. You know, my goal, like with Esther, is to probably get 3 topics in each week. But I know that that may not be doable some weeks, and I know that some weeks we can do more than 3. It's going to vary. The book of Malachim, the book of Kings itself, structurally. So first of all, I brought you in source number 9, a passage from the Gemara in Bava Basra. We saw this last year when we talked about Eicha. Yirmiyahu is credited with writing his own book, as well as the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, as well as Keynote. And of course, Keynote is... What is Keynote referring to?
Eicha.
Eicha, correct, Lamentations. So Yirmiyahu is the writer of Malachim, even though obviously Shlomo lives a long time before Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu's period is the last decades of the first temple, and Shlomo is the builder of the first temple, and in between you have 410 years. So he's not a first-hand reporter. Nonetheless, he's credited with writing Shlomo's story and all the way through Malachim until it finally arrives at the time of Yirmiyahu, whether he's doing it all as prophecy, prophecy combined with records, however you want to understand that. It is all one book. Professor Keel, in his introduction to Malachim, goes to great lengths to demonstrate that from a literary perspective, this is a single composition. When we say single composition, that also means there's no such thing as Malachim Aleph and Malachim Bet. It is just Malachim. Just like, for those who have been learning Shmuel with me, there is no Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet. There is Shmuel. That's it. The two books split starts with the Greek translations. That seems to be where it's from, and largely a matter of convenience. It's fascinating. When you learn Shmuel, the split between Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet at least makes sense. Right? Where is the split from a content perspective in Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet? What's the decision to put one in one and one in the other? What happens?
It's the death of Shaul and then beginning of David's reign.
Precisely. Shaul's death is the last event in Shmuel Aleph, and then Shmuel Bet, King David's trying to take over, although Shaul has a son and so on. But yes, that's with Shmuel. Malachim, as Professor Keel notes, it's entirely just a matter of space convenience. It's a matter of saying, let's get the same number of chapters or number of verses roughly in the first half as the second half. That's all it is, because it comes in the middle of the reign of King Ahaziah in the northern kingdom, King Yehoshaphat in the southern kingdom. It's in the middle of the reign of kings, and it's in the middle of Eliyahu HaNavi's career, the prophet Eliyahu. It's not like there's one prophet before and one prophet after. It doesn't make any sense, that split. Yes, Ricky.
Are the Prakim also a later development, or was it?
Yeah.
Because in the Torah there is no Prakim.
Correct. The Prakim, the chapters, are a gift of the Catholic Church. that's what they are. They were a church thing which Jews went along with, like the split of the book, because they ended up in this position in which they had to navigate Jewish-Christian relations and debates. And they were forced to refer to the book by those Christian terms. Neither the split nor the chapters were our idea.
And the sentences also, the psukim also?
Well, the psukim are not marked as psukim in an original parchment edition of it, but we did break them into verses ourselves. That wasn't something that was imposed on us. We were already reading them as verses. In terms of the...
I was just wondering, when we say Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem, do we mean Shlomo in the time of Shlomo, or there is a better time to say?
So you'll have to wait until we get to chapter 10, and that's where we discuss the utopia. We discuss the utopia a little bit in chapter 5, so maybe we'll sneak it in there. But basically, it's chapter 10. Yes, Ruth.
If you're looking for the division of sentences, even though there's no punctuation in the Torah, we have the traditional trough.
Yes.
And the trough will lay out what is the beginning, the middle, and the end of the sentence.
Correct. The trough does it, and that's one way in which you know it, but also you find Talmudically that they're describing sentences as sentences. No one is ever discussing chapters there. They refer to passages based on verse, and also based on what they called parsha, but they didn't mean parsha like a Torah portion. They meant where there are gaps in the text. You know, if you look in the parchment, there are gaps, either a small gap or a larger one. That's where one parsha ends and a new parsha begins. They're p'tuchot and stumot, for those who are familiar with the terms. In terms of the content of this book, so the theme is the monarchy in the first temple period, the first Beit HaMikdash. If you look at source number 10, I quoted for you from Don Isaac Abarbanel's introduction to the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel. This is something that some of you have done with me before. But he was addressing the question of why the book of Shmuel is called Shmuel. Shmuel dies in Shmuel Aleph. I realize that those who are learning Shmuel with me haven't seen that yet, and that's maybe a spoiler. But Shmuel doesn't even make it into Shmuel Bet. Shmuel dies before Shaul. So why is the whole book, which is going to go on for a very long time after that, called Shmuel? So take a look at number 10. In the interest of time, I'm just going to read my English translation, but you can see the Hebrew there as well. Abarbanel wrote, "To me, this book was not called Shmuel because he wrote it. It's not just because he's the author. He's not the author of the whole thing. Natan and God fill in the rest. But for two other reasons. First, the content of the book, its stories and lessons all associate with Shmuel the prophet. And even though you'll say, well, again, Shmuel dies, but Shaul and King David are his creations. So therefore, it's considered his. And second, he says, and this is the part I wanted to focus on, for as I already mentioned in the introduction to the book of Joshua, logically, the stories of Eli and Shmuel, judges of Israel, should have been included in the book of Judges, Shophan. And the affairs of Shaul and David should have been included in the book of Kings, in Malachim. Right? If you're talking about kings, let's start from the beginning. But this book itself, Shmuel, is dedicated to the stature of the most complete and holy of the judges, Shmuel the prophet, and the completeness of the most elevated king, David, servant of God. The book of Shmuel is about Shmuel and David. To tell about Shmuel, it needed to tell about Eli the judge, who preceded him as well. So it starts out with Eli and the story of Hannah and so on. And since Shmuel and David were the essential goal of this book, and it was right that it take its name from only one of them, not both, for a book doesn't have two names, our sages saw that it would be more fitting for this book to be named for Shmuel than for David due to his holiness, his piety, his prophecy." That's a very interesting assertion, that a book can't have two names. I think if it had two names, we would just call it that. We would call it Shmuel v'David, and that would be that. But nonetheless, that's the idea that Abarbanel proposes, and I bring it here just to explain that that's why David is not in Melachim. Shmuel was meant to teach about these two great role models, Shmuel and David, and it starts the end of David's reign, and it goes through the kings of the northern kingdom until Assyria exiles them, and the kings of the southern kingdom, the kings of Yehuda, until Babel, until Babylon destroys the southern kingdom. Yes, Ricky.
So the Christian church divided into Malachim. We had Psukim. So who named the books?
Sorry?
Who named the book Shmuel?
Oh, so that's an interesting question, but the Gemara already views it as being named Shmuel, whereas some books have multiple names over time, like Keynote becomes called Echa. It seems like they always called it Shmuel.
But in the Torah...
What do you mean in the Torah? There's nowhere in Chumash where they're going to refer to the names of the later books. There's nowhere that I can think of in Tanakh where we say Sefer Shmuel, refer to it as Sefer Shmuel. The only book that I can think of that gets named offhand, and I reserve the right to change my mind on this later, but the only one I can think of is Divrei Hayamim.
So where does the name Shmuel come from? Where does it appear for the first time?
The name for the book? I don't know. By the time you get to Talmudic literature, it's already being called that, and we don't have a whole lot of books in between.
So it's somewhere in the books that are missing, there is some...
There's some practice of calling it Shmuel. I don't know more than that. It's an interesting question, but I couldn't answer it. As I said to you in the beginning of this class, there's overlap between the account that we get in Melachim and the account in Divrei Hayamim, the Book of Chronicles. Divrei Hayamim is written by Ezra in the beginning of the Second Temple period. Each of these books supplements and at times contradicts the other. I gave you a reference on the sheet. If you take a look at source number 11, I gave you a list of the chapters that you should read if you want to get the Divrei Hayamim, the Chronicles perspective, on the reign of Shlomo. you get some from what's called Divrei Hayamim Aleph and some from Divrei Hayamim Beth, another book that's really just one book, but got split into two for portability purposes. So why is it that some things make it into the version of Yirmiyahu in Malachim, and some elements of the story only make it into Divrei Hayamim? So I brought you some sources here, and I've discussed it in other classes, so I don't want to go into it at real length. But take a look at source number 12. My first part, when I brought you a number 12, was gratuitous. I brought it here just because it's such a fun line that I can't resist. From Rabindel's introduction to Shmuel, he's addressing a particular question that I think, if I remember correctly, it's the question of why David can't build the Beit HaMikdash. And he writes about it, and there are different versions of why, as we'll get to discuss. And there's one version that only shows up in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles. So he says, V'gama sefer ahu Divrei Hayamim biltina hu ge'etel ha-Yehudim b'midrashayhem. He says, you know, Jews don't really study this book, Divrei Hayamim. And he says, Eschata'ay ani mazkir hayom, I mentioned my own sin today, ki lo karasi bo miyamai, I never read it in my life. And he says, I never even looked into it. From the time I was born until today, I knew there was a book called Divrei Hayamim. It's at the end of the shelf. It makes sure that all the other books don't fall off the shelf. But I had no idea what it was. So once Abarbanel says that, none of us should feel bad. But number 13 is really where I'm going with this, in which he talks about, in 13 and 14, he talks about the difference between the goal of Malachim and the goal of Divrei Hayamim. And I think this is very important for us. So look at number 13, please. He says, Va'omar, he says, I say, Shanavi Hazeh, this prophet, by which he means Shmuel, Kivein Lizkor in Yanei Davidu Ma'asav HaRishumim. He wanted to mention David's matters and his deeds. He's talking about Shmuel now, which are recorded there. Ve'ein Zeh L'Tachlis HaSifur HaMuchlat. It's not just to tell a story. Kisifrei Divrei Hayamim Asher Yasu HaUmos Kulam Me'in Yaneihem. Like the chronicles that books, that the nations compose. Kiyem L'Tachlis HaLimu La'Avodas HaKel Yisparach. The goal in Sefer Shmuel is to learn how to serve God. What does God like and what does God dislike? And then he goes on to say, there are four different types of stories that you'll find there. Stories about the completeness of King David, stories that tell about his mistakes, his sins, stories that speak of what God did on his behalf, and stories that talk about the punishments that God gave him. That's what Shmuel is for. And he contrasts that with Divrei Hayamim. Take a look at number 14. He says, Kasher ra'a ha-sofer ha-shalem hazeh, sha-shvatim asher huglu ashura safu. When this great scribe, I'm assuming sofer is scribe, when we learned Ezra, we learned that it may not mean that. Nonetheless, when this complete scribe saw that the tribe's exile to Assyria had been finished, v'nosura bas tzion, and the daughter of Zion remained, and he saw that God had given monarchy to David and his descendants forever. And all the other kings we had who were not from the Davidic line, those were not who God wanted. And in the future, it's just going to be the Davidic line. So Ezra sees that the future of the Jewish monarchy is with the line of David. Chashav lemalas hamelach David lesaper yichuso v'yichus shivto v'inyano u'ma'asav kulam hamorim al shlemuso. So therefore, Ezra thought, you know what I need to do? I need to create a book of propaganda. I need to create a book that's going to encourage everybody to see David and his lineage and his descendants as being ideal and wonderful, shalem, complete. That's what is needed. And then he talks about his descendants, about David's descendants. So he says, in Divrei Hayamim, the goal is meant to favor, in his day, in the day of Ezra, Zerubbabel, who is the descendant of who's the descendant of David. That's what it's about. And that's why some of the big stories of King David don't show up in Divrei Hayamim. Most glaringly, the whole story of Bathsheba, not there. Never happened. It's not there. As a matter of fact, she's actually named Bathsheba in Divrei Hayamim, which is very interesting because you remember the original Bathsheba was Yehuda's wife. I see you, Chana. It's just not there. Why? Because anybody who reads that story is not able to look at King David the same way ever again. You're not going to look at that line, and by the way, Shlomo is their son, you're not going to look at the line the same way. So that's omitted from Divrei Hayamim. But again, that's not what Shmuel is for. And it's not what Malachim is for either. The goals of these books is to try to give us more than just this king was wonderful. It's meant to teach us lessons, practical lessons. And if you take a look at source... Yeah.
I could keep thinking what you just said. I mean, I could think Bathsheba and Solomon, and from that union comes Solomon. It doesn't feel right that, yes, when they went back to that original list of the rabbis, he didn't merit the fourth thing, but David merits so much when this is what happened. I mean, he sent the guy off to the front to die so he can have the wife. I mean, it's like terrible. It's like, you know, I just keep thinking of that. I don't think, well, we're all human, but that's like such a huge infringement.
Yeah, I'm really glad I'm not teaching Shmuel Beth. it's a very hard story. I mean, I have an approach to it, but there's no way to square that circle. There just isn't. This is a problem.
Just one other question. You know how you say that the sins of the fathers are visited, the sons are visited, the sins of the fathers are visited on the sons? Can we draw a parallel here? Or could we draw a line, or is that totally ridiculous thing to draw that line?
So it's not ridiculous. We're going to see right from the beginning of the book how some of the greatest crises of David's time are inherited by Shlomo. So, you know, I mean, that's not, I wouldn't call it necessarily God punishing Shlomo for it, but he has a reality he has to deal with. He has a problem. I just want to show you, just to wrap up that piece from Abarbanel, if you look at number 15, he says, Uklal gadol ye gam kim bo biyadecha. You should have the following great principle in your hand. Shalihios kavanas ha-sefer hazeh lahudia ulhagib bo malas David ha-melech u'shlemu yosav. V'lo yadato lizkor hinyanim asher asak kodam lachaso ki enam ela b'meshehu melech. You know what? Actually, we don't need it. I think I basically covered it. So rather than take the time on that, it's okay. You can read it yourself and it'll be good. But this way we can get through the introduction. King David's monarchy affects King Solomon's monarchy in very concrete ways. What I was just saying to Rose, we can identify three prolonged and interwoven crises in King David's career. What are the three major overarching crises of King David's career?
Are we talking about when he becomes king, or, for instance, when Saul turns against him?
I would go back to when, I would consider it anything from when Shmuel first anoints him.
So then when Shaul decides to kill him?
Yeah. As a fugitive from Shaul, definitely one of the three. What else? So, sorry, Hana, you're muted.
Bathsheba and Absalom.
Right. The sin with Bathsheba, and then the fallout with his daughter Tamar and his son Amnon, and then Avshalom and Amnon, and then Avshalom's revolt. All of that is one long catastrophe, a result of what he did with Bathsheba. So that's your second crisis. And then the third one is his relationship with Hashem, in which we are told initially multiple times that God is with him, but it doesn't stop him from making mistakes, And it doesn't stop God from punishing him on multiple occasions. Right? For somebody who, about whom we say he's so wonderful and so perfect, he gets punished an awful lot. So that's, I view as his third crisis of sorts. And all of them come to a head in the issue of national unity. And Moish, this goes back to your email that you sent me this morning, which I didn't have a chance to answer yet.
Also, the one that, because he had all these thousand women, and he was worshiping their God.
So right now I'm on how David affects Solomon. I'm not on Shlomo yet. But I'm going to, Moish, I see your hand. Just give me a moment. All of this comes to a head in the issue of unity. Because Yehuda and Yisrael, Yehuda the southern kingdom, Yisrael the northern kingdom, they saw themselves as separate, going all the way back to the period of the Shoftim, the judges. You had tribes who went to war to help each other, you had tribes who did not go to war to help each other, you had a military census in which you counted Yehuda and separately counted Yisrael. In the time of Yehoshua, you can make the argument that there was already something of a split when Yehoshua is afraid that if Achan from the tribe of Yehuda does not admit his guilt, he's going to have problems with the nation, because Yehoshua is from Ephraim and Achan is from Yehuda. This split is an old split. I mean, you can argue it goes back to Rachel and Leah, but the point is that that it's already there. And David being on the run from Shaul is part of that. Shaul's family is going to be supported by Yisrael, whereas David is from Yehuda. Yehuda, in Shmuel Bet, chapter 2, Yehuda anoints David. If you look at number 16, I gave you some references to chapters there. We're not looking them up now. But in chapter 2 of Shmuel Bet, the tribe of Yehuda anoints David. Yisrael follows Ishbosheth, the son of Shaul. After Ishbosheth is killed, Yisrael comes and anoints David in chapter 5. In chapter 19, there's even competition between Yisrael and Yehuda to be close to David. But then in chapter 20, we find that there's a revolt by a man named Sheva ben Bichri, and Yisrael follows him in his revolt. So much so that King David, in the next chapter, in Divrei Hayamim, counts his army, because he's afraid that he can't rely on Yisrael for support. He does a census to see, who do I have on my side? So this split is there from in the time of King David and even earlier, and it becomes an issue for Shlomo on multiple levels. At the beginning of his reign, Shlomo has to deal with fallout from that rift in the missions that David gives him, punishing General Yoav, rewarding loyal Barzillai, punishing Shimei ben Gera, who cursed him during Avshalom's rebellion. We're going to see Adoniyahu attempt a revolt, and his support, or a coup really, and his support comes from the people who didn't like King David's reign. And at the end, we will find the kingdoms actually split. Although, interestingly, Shaul's tribe of Binyamin is going to stay with Yehuda. That's its own story, which we may get to. All right, Moish, you were very patient. Where are you? There you are. Go ahead.
You know, your point about the differences between, I'll just call them the two cultures rather than the two religions, is phenomenal. I've actually never heard it, and it's so true. It's rarely in the text. In fact, I would say it's never in the text from what little I remember. But it's the backdrop to everything. It's the absolute backdrop, and that's why when he's gone, they're so quick to get out of the picture. But I something just came to me that I think is incredible. And this is horrific, because I think that David acquired the psyche to kill Uriah from the monarchy. From he said, well, I can take 10 tribes, and it's going to be my country, in my monarchy. There's going to be nobody. What's the wife compared to that?
So I'm going to leave that, not because I I'm going to leave it just because I really don't want to tackle the story of David and Bathsheba today, especially not with 5 minutes remaining. But it's an interesting thought. It's definitely an interesting thought. I wanted to just note two other things. There are other ways in which King David's reign shapes King Solomon's reign. We're going to see, God willing, David actually set aside real estate and materials for the Beis HaMikdash, which Shlomo then builds. David is already setting up his son to do it. David is credited with writing Tehillim, with writing Psalms. Shlomo, as we've mentioned, Song of Songs, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. God says he is with David, protecting him and his line, because David follows God, and God will demand the same of Solomon, of Shlomo. But he starts from the default perspective, of course you're going to follow your father's model. Interestingly, both of them are kings for the same period of time. How long were each of them king? Anybody know? Sorry, Ellen, you're muted. No. 40 years. Each of them were kings for 40 years. David is first 7 in Hebron and then 33 in Yerushalayim, and Shlomo is straight 40 in Yerushalayim. At the same time, Shlomo is really his own man. He's really his own man. And he charts his own path. David is known for passionate emuna, constant faith in God. Those who have learned Shmuel with me, right? You think of all the times that he just jumps out in front and he does what he believes God wants him to do, and without a care in the world about what's going to happen to him. Shlomo is known for chokhmah. He's known for wisdom, thinking things through. I mean, maybe with the weddings he should have thought again, but you get the idea. We have to talk about that, by the way. That's a question that I want to answer this year. I don't have an answer yet. But how can someone so smart think that that was a good idea? So I do want to discuss that. Number two, in terms of differences, David spends much of his life as a pauper and a fugitive. In the beginning, some people were talking about David leaving Shlomo things. We don't find David as a figure of wealth. Shlomo, on the other hand, is wealthy and powerful. And third, and this to me is the most intriguing, and I don't know what to do with it, but I find it fascinating, David's story is bigger than himself. When we learn about David, we learn about his wives, right? Michal, Abigail, Bathsheba. We learn about his generals, Avner, Yoav, Amasa. We learn about his rebellious children, right? We know so much more about his kids than like anybody else's kids in Tanakh, maybe even more than Yaakov's kids. We know about Adoniyahu, and we know about Amnon, and we know about Tamar, and we know about Avshalom, and we know, of course, about Shlomo. All of these other figures, when we learn Shlomo's story, I mean, if you looked at the topics that I gave you on the sheet when I did the syllabus part, it's really the Shlomo show. Hiram, king of Tsur, makes it into the story a little bit. The people in the beginning who Shlomo is supposed to either kill or reward, right, are there. The only wife out of 1,000 who we know anything at all is Bat-Paro, daughter of Pharaoh. We know her name. That's it. It's really remarkable that with David, we know so many other people. There's a whole cast. And with Shlomo, it's the spotlight is on him. And I don't know how much of that is because of who he was. It's lonely at the top. And how much of it is because of the way Yirmiyahu chooses to tell the story versus the way that Shmuel tells the story of David. I don't know. Keeping in mind that Shmuel doesn't actually tell David's story. It's God and Natan who tell David's story. But I don't know what to do with it, but I find it to be a fascinating thing. And so I'm really looking forward to this year, to getting a chance to learn something that for me is new and different and involves somebody who, like I said very early on, he's so well known. He's such a figure in Judaism and in general global society, and yet I feel like I don't know him. So looking forward to learning about him with you this year. Thank you very, very much for joining. And again, a push before people all sign off. If you haven't yet registered with Rebecca, please do see Rebecca. You can scroll up in the chat if you joined before it was put there for the link for the registration form. If you don't know it, just email me or email Rebecca at makarota18@gmail.com, and Rebecca just put the link in again. So thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.